Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's the Friday News Roundup, where we check in with area journalists for the stories making regional headlines this week. The Trump administration has announced what it's calling a pause in some federal funding through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The state says this is likely to affect funding for the Cape Cod Bridges project. And we look at the response to unlawful street takeovers in several Massachusetts communities. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Mindy.
So let's start with the bridges. How much money could be delayed, and how do we know this involves the Cape bridges?
Yes, well, $350 million from the Army Corps of Engineers is what is at stake right now for the bridges. And that's not all the federal funding for the Bourne and Sagamore bridges, certainly far from it, but it's the amount that is at risk from the Army Corps of Engineers right now. And what happened was that last Friday, the director of the Office of Management and Budget for the Trump administration posted on social media that the Army Corps was going to be pausing more than $11 billion in funding for various projects that he called lower priority. And they're not just pausing the money, but also considering it for cancellation. Now, how do we know that this includes the Cape? Well, I talked on Monday with the head of the bridge project for the state, Louisa Piwanski. She said that although the state at that point had not received any official notice about it, they had heard from contacts in Washington that that was the intent of the Trump administration, was to include the bridge funding. One positive note, though, for supporters of the bridges, I found out from Piwanski that the Army Corps money involved in this really wasn't due to come to Massachusetts until at least late in 2027. It's specifically intended for construction, and they still have a lot of things to do before that.
So right now, this threat to the bridge funding seems to be related to the government shutdown, right?
Yes, it appears that that's the case. So what was indicated in the Trump administration's post on X was that, according to Russell Vogt, that's the director of the OMB, he said the shutdown has drained the Army Corps' ability to manage these projects. So at least in theory, once the shutdown is over, that funding could be back. But it still doesn't really explain that issue of the possible canceling of the funding that he talked about.
Yeah. And the $350 million that could be lost from the Army Corps is really just a small part of what it will actually cost to replace the bridges, right?
That's right. Yes. So the overall estimate for both bridges combined is $4.5 billion. Roughly half of that is funded right now, with the intent that much of that half would go toward the Sagamore Bridge, of course, because that's being built first. But there are some steps actually that are happening right now, like the environmental permitting, that apply to both bridges at once. But to your point, yeah, the federal government has committed a lot of other money from different sources that are not this, like Department of Transportation grants and things like that, that are not affected here. There is actually another $1.3 billion, Piwanski said, in federal funding that has come to the bridges so far, plus state money. There's about almost three quarters of a billion from the state.
Both the Bourne and Sagamore bridges need major repairs if they're not replaced. Remind us how things could play out if the bridges are not replaced in time.
Sure. Yeah. So the issue here is that bridges of this age need major rehabilitation to stay safe. And the Army Corps, which owns the bridges right now, they're going to be transferred to the state. But right now, the Army Corps owns them. They said in a 2020 report that the Sagamore Bridge would need that kind of major rehab work starting this year, 2025. And the Bournewood Bridge would need it in 2029 if they were not replaced. So that level of work, it's not repairs. It's major. It would require hundreds of days of lane closures. And each bridge would actually be fully closed for more than 100 days, almost 200 days for the Bourne Bridge. Many people on the Cape, especially the Chamber of Commerce, have talked about how devastating that would be to have them closed. for the economy, but also just for like the basic movement of people on and off the Cape.
Yeah, nightmare is what it sounds like.
All right. Yes, yes.
Let's talk about street takeovers. These are illegal on-road meetups that involve people blocking public intersections and staging vehicle competitions. And they're doing stunts like donuts or racing. Boston.com reported that those takeovers happened in at least 5 communities on a single weekend in early October. So tell us what's being done about this and what is the Cape connection.
Yes, well, as far as what's being done about it, Governor Maura Healey directed the state police to conduct some special operations to prevent them. And that was like right after that big weekend of takeovers. The state police did some of those operations the very next weekend, and they made 7 arrests. They cited hundreds of people with various violations, towed 15 vehicles, seized 2 vehicles. One thing people should realize is these events are not just about doing donuts, right? People's behavior often gets out of hand. At one of them in Boston, a police car was set on fire, plus blocking those streets is a safety hazard. So the Cape connection, at least 2 bills have been filed to try to crack down on this behavior. Both of those bills were filed by state reps from our immediate CAI listening area. One is Representative Stephen Exaros, who's a Republican from Barnstable, and the other is Chris Markey of Dartmouth, who is a Democrat. Mm-hmm.
At least one Boston commentator has raised some objections to the Exaros bill. What are the concerns?
Well, the main issue that's been raised with that bill is about criminalizing spectators to a street takeover, not just the people who are in the cars. There's a story on Mass Live, the news website, that pointed out that Exaros's bill would punish both participants and spectators. And following that, Dan Kennedy, who's a journalism professor at Northeastern University and a commentator on media issues, he wrote about it. And I interviewed him this week. He says the treatment of spectators in Exaros's bill raises concerns for him about freedom of assembly. The way the bill is written now, if someone is intentionally obstructing traffic for the purpose of watching the event, they can get jail time of up to 2.5 years. There's also a separate provision in his bill that's just about being a spectator unrelated to blocking traffic, and that can get you a fine. And Kennedy says that those punishments could be applied to the general public for showing up, or also to journalists who are there to write about what's going on. So he says, it seems like laws on the books that are already on the books should be able to address the kinds of crimes that really make up one of these events.
So what does Representative Exaros have to say about it?
Well, I interviewed him as well. And, you know, he disagrees with that assessment. He said emphatically that his idea of a spectator is someone who planned to show up, like they're in the audience for a show. He said that someone who's an innocent bystander who just watches what's unfolding, or a news reporter doing their job, those are not people that he wants to target. But he does think that a law about this is necessary, because he says oftentimes people who do these takeovers are just getting like a ticket for driving to endanger or some violation like that. And he feels that's really not a serious enough penalty to reflect what is actually happening here. But as far as the spectators go, it's really like a matter of the specifics of the bill language. What exactly is a spectator? How do you define spectating? And Exaros said himself that bills often get revised, you know, as the process goes along. So it's possible that could happen as well.
And this bill is modeled after a law in Florida, right?
Yes, it was. He had talked about that in the Mass Live story, that he was looking at the Florida language. The Florida law is different in a number of ways, though. And Dan Kennedy says that the Florida law actually defines spectators more narrowly than Exaros's bill. What's in the Florida law is it adds a requirement that when officials are considering citing someone as a spectator, they have to consider some specific evidence of that spectator actually being involved there, Like, was the person gambling on the event? Were they filming it? Were they posting video on social media? Things like that. So Dan Kennedy pointed out that Czaros's bill actually does not have those requirements.
You mentioned a second bill on this by a legislator from the South Coast. Can you tell us about that one?
Sure. That's by Representative Chris Markey from Dartmouth. His bill does not mention spectators at all, actually. It does allow up to 2.5 years of jail time for someone who drives recklessly or obstructs traffic in a group, is how he's kind of defining this kind of behavior, is that it's in a group of two or more vehicles. It also, his bill also adds a penalty for being disorderly while wearing a mask. And I think most likely that's because of something that actually happened during this takeover scenario recently, which is that according to the police, some of the people participating in the takeover in the town of Randolph were wearing masks. But both of the bills here, the Markey bill from the Democrat and the Czaros bill from the Republican, both have provisions for vehicles involved in a takeover to be forfeited. And that could be a key provision if that is not really happening now.
Yeah. And Governor Maura Healey held a press conference with police recently to talk about what they've done to prevent street takeovers under current law. Does she support the idea of new laws on this?
Well, it looks like she might, depending on the specifics. I talked with Healey's press secretary, Carissa Hand, and she told me that the state has zero tolerance for dangerous driving and that Governor Healey does appreciate seeing new proposals being brought forward on this.
All right. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thank you.
Thanks, Mindy.
Months after allegations of misconduct at the East Falmouth Police Academy surfaced, the State Municipal Police Training Committee is out with a new report. CAI's Gilda Geist is here to talk about that. Hi, Gilda.
Hi, Mindy.
Oh, sorry. What are the findings?
Yeah, so MPTC found evidence of repeated violations of MPTC policies and safety guidelines at the East Falmouth Police Academy, which is brand new and opened up to student officers earlier this year. It's a 46-page report, which I did read, but we don't have time to get into everything. But one of the most common violations was using physical training as punishment, which is explicitly prohibited in MPTC training materials that all staff members received. So, for example, one day a student failed their uniform inspection and a staff member believed that the student lied about ironing the uniform, so all the students had to do training exercises outside and were made to pour water over themselves. And this was a day where the high was 32 degrees. Mm. Here's just a quote from the report real quick. One student officer reported that the army crawling up Windmill Hill, that's a hill where they do exercises, caused a large wound to his knee that bled through his pants, unquote. And so they were supposed to be reporting injuries and to the MPTC, and that was not the only injury that went unreported.
So what were the consequences for staff who were involved in misconduct?
Yeah, so the Academy's two main leaders, former Falmouth Police Chief Edward Dunn and former Franklin County Sheriff Christopher Donnellan, they had their contracts terminated as a result of this investigation. And 5 out of 9 staff instructors at the Academy had their MPTC instructor certifications revoked.
And how did the allegations come to light in the first place?
So it started with an academic instructor at the academy reporting their concerns to the MPTC back in February. At that point, the MPTC called a meeting with academy staff. They went over all the policies and expectations again. But later, leaders at police departments that had student officers at the academy started reaching out to the MPTC with similar concerns. Plymouth PD sent a 35-page report, and the Barnstable police chief wrote a letter saying that two of her student officers went to the academy were military veterans and said that their experience at the academy was, quote, worse than boot camp.
Wow. All right. What did the MPTC say about how these kinds of violations could be avoided in the future?
So they say they're going to start doing unannounced audits of police academies, and they also want to review their training procedures. Interestingly, the report includes detailed information about exactly what training material staff received and when. And I'll quote the report one last time here again. Throughout this investigation, when the East Falmouth Academy staff were questioned about their conduct, many of them claimed that the MPTC didn't provide any guidance about how to run the academy. Quite simply, this isn't true, unquote. So we're not really sure what the review of the training procedures is going to look like, but that's their plan moving forward. And also worth mentioning that the four staff members who were not involved in this misconduct will be reinstated to their jobs.
All right. See you guys, Gilda Geis. Thanks, Gilda.
Thank you.
The annual count of critically endangered North Atlantic right whales is out, and CAI's Amy Culp-Noyes is here to talk about that. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, so good news. The number is up. Not way up, but it's up.
That's right. The new estimate is 384, and that's up from 376, so it's just over 2% increase.
And how accurate is this count?
Well, the range of error is plus 10 and minus 9, so the gain of 8 whales is within that margin of error. But scientists are still cautiously optimistic. This marks the fourth year in a row where the population has made small gains, and that comes after a sharp decline between 2015 and 2020. And researchers say 11 calves were born this year, and that includes 4 to first-time mothers. And that's really significant because right whales have been putting off having their first calves until they're older.
Do we know why they're delaying having calves?
It probably has something to do with a lack of food in recent years. I spoke with Heather Pettis, who leads the right whale research program at the New England Aquarium's Anderson Cabot Center, and she also chairs the North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium. She says warmer ocean temperatures have driven the zooplankton that right whales eat farther north. So the prime feeding grounds are changing, and that's led to a few problems. First, reproductive age females are smaller than average, and giving birth is quite taxing on them. And second, it's harder to predict where the whales might be, so it's more difficult to protect them from vessel strikes and fishing gear entanglements. Pettis says there's currently 72 reproductively active females, and they would normally be expected to live between 60 and 80 years, but they've only been living to 30 or 40. Mm-hmm. And once females start having calves, they can reproduce for the rest of their lives. So those shorter lifespans have been will have a big impact on the population as a whole.
And have strikes and entanglements been a big problem this year?
Yes. Well, not this year, but they are still the leading cause for serious injury and deaths in North Atlantic right whales. But so far, scientists haven't recorded any deaths in 2025. They've noted one vessel strike and one entanglement injury. And this year isn't over, but so far, it's been a good year on that front. Last year, scientists recorded 5 right whale deaths and 16 entanglements and 8 vessel strikes.
Let's hope the good news continues.
Let's hope.
All right. So you also reported this week on a North Falmouth company that's attempting to complete the first global circumnavigation with an autonomous underwater vehicle. How's that going?
Yeah, it's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's going so far so good. The mission's launched on October 11th, about 60 miles off of Woods Hole, out past Nantucket and the wind farm. The mission is a partnership between Rutgers University and Teledyne Marine, specifically Teledyne Marine's subsidiary, Teledyne Webb Research, which is in North Falmouth. It's called the Sentinel Mission, and that's named for the Slocum Sentinel glider, which is the brand of glider manufactured by Teledyne. The specific glider on this mission is called Red Wing, and that's an acronym which honors Webb Research founder and Falmouth resident Doug Webb, who died last fall. Red Wing stands for Research and Education Doug Webb International Glider.
And what are the mission's goals beyond making it all the way around the globe?
Well, as the name implies, there are research and educational goals. Red Wing is equipped with a CTD sensor that measures the water's conductivity, which is a gauge of salinity, as well as the temperature and depth. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, collects this information for weather prediction models, and Red Wing will transmit the data it collects to NOAA each time it surfaces. And Red Wing's also equipped with something called a VEMCO VMT that receives pings from tagged marine animals. And there hasn't been much opportunity so far to search for those pings far offshore where Red Wing's going to be. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. And as for the educational goals, Project Lead Shay Quinn says that's a big part of the mission. First of all, dozens of undergraduate students at Rutgers University have worked on the project. And Quinn says his company also partnered with Rutgers back in 2009 for the first glider transoceanic crossing. And he says these long-term endurance missions involve a lot of planning and piloting, and the students are involved in both of those aspects. And they've also been doing outreach for the project. So the students have gotten in touch with experts along the mission route that can take the glider out of the water, refresh its batteries, make any needed repairs, and at the same time, educate local students and scientists about the project. And also, the Rutgers students have set up a website where anyone can follow Red Wing's progress, and it even has an Instagram account.
So where is Red Wing headed right now?
Right now, it's headed out into the Gulf Stream, which it will ride up to the Canary Islands. Then it will head down to South Africa, and from there all the way to Perth in Western Australia, then around Australia to New Zealand. And then the longest leg, over 15,000 kilometers, is from New Zealand to South America. It will have one more stop there, but that is yet to be pinpointed. And then it will head back to the Cape.
Do they plan to pick it up exactly where they launched it?
Yes, yes. There are specific rules for completing an official circumnavigation of the globe, and that is one of them.
And what are the other rules?
Well, it has to pass the equator twice. You have to stay in a certain latitude range, so you can't just circle around Antarctica and call it done. You have to hit two antipodes, which are points directly across the globe from each other. So with Red Wing, they plan to hit one antipode in the North Atlantic and the other just south of Australia.
And how long is all of this going to take?
Well, the current projection is 4.5 to 5 years.
Wow.
So in order to complete the long stretches of this mission, Red Wing needs to be super efficient. And part of the way that happens is by traveling at a really slow pace. So Red Wing will be going under a knot.
All right. CAI's Amy Goldnoise. Thank you, Amy.
My pleasure.
Coming up, amid PFAS concerns, Chilmark School switches to bottled water. And Nantucket's real estate market topped $1 billion in annual sales in September, weeks ahead of last year's pace. Stay with us. You're listening to the Friday News Roundup on The Point. Three people were rescued from the Shaun Island after their boat caught fire. They were forced to swim ashore and take refuge for 2 days. Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with the details. Morning, Sam.
Good morning, Linda.
So this is quite the ordeal. Their boat catches on fire. Luckily, they were close enough to be able to swim to shore.
Yeah, a pretty just crazy story. And we actually sadly heard an unfortunate kind of twist this morning, but the mother, her name was Cece Sullivan, actually died yesterday afternoon. So, you know, a difficult development there.
Sure.
Yeah, and a story, you know, this story's really caught the attention, you could say, of the country. ABC had a feature on it earlier this week. But right, as for the details of what we know happened, and this is from different news reports from the Coast Guard, local agencies. But the Sullivan family from the Cape, they were sitting out from their boat from Falmouth with the intention of staying a few nights. There's three of them, and they anchored near Tarpaulin Cove, a popular spot for boaters. Mm-hmm. And sometime Monday evening, the Coast Guard believes was an electrical issue, and the boat caught fire. We understand their dog actually alerted the family and to wake them up. And the three were able to swim to shore. They apparently found a farmhouse to shelter in. It seems no one was there at the time, and they ended up staying for 30 hours before they were rescued. We're not 100% sure, you know, why they stuck there. We haven't reached the family directly. But the Coast Guard informed us that the son came across the boat's radio system that had kind of washed ashore on the beach. He was able to call in a mayday, and that prompted the rescue. I think that the news this morning is unfortunate in their family.
Sorry to hear that. So fear over ICE raids continue, despite what seems like a slowdown of those detained on the island.
Yeah. So the ICE kind of announced this Operation Patriot 2.0 earlier in September, and they announced kind of the end of the month that something like 1,400 were detained across Massachusetts. And we wanted to look at, you know, what happened locally on the island. And what we heard from police and locals, really, there was no raid that we heard of. No one was detained. But we did know that the chef and owner of a popular Caribbean restaurant in Oak Bluffs was actually detained in Falmouth. From what we understand, no criminal history whatsoever, that he overstayed his visa. We also know of an incident in Buzzards Bay, another barbershop owner owned a barbershop in Edgartown, was also deported. So I think it's, you know, there's been a cool down, not the same as we had last spring where there was just that very visible large raid, but it's really having an impact locally. And Brazilians, Jamaican community are feeling that fear, and there's just these false rumors that go around too that keep people staying home and indoors.
But. Yeah. You also have a follow-up on the PFAS story from a couple of weeks ago when a Chilmark woman came forward to talk about her experience and hope others would have their blood tested for PFAS levels. And this is prompting more PFAS testing, right?
Yeah, right. She came forward. She had a cancer diagnosis, and her doctors say there could be a link to the PFAS that was in her private well. So last week, kind of prompting that cry, the Board of Health decided they're going to work with families in Chilmark to coordinate testing of their private wells. They stopped short of paying outright for the tests, as they were considering earlier, but they're grouping them together and coordinating with the idea that it could save some money there. But the news this week, we learned that the Chilmark School, an elementary school, will be switching to bottled water. For the past several years, there have been samples of PFAS in the water there. The levels were really below a state standard for drinking water. But the federal government, as we know, last year set out these new standards that basically say any PFAS in the water is too much. And so the school, really this week, I think, you know, falls in line with this woman coming forward, decided they're going to look into kind of filtration systems. But in the meantime, they'll be providing bottled water.
Yeah, sounds like a smart move. All right, Sam Houghton with the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Mindy.
Nantucket's real estate market topped $1 billion in annual sales in September, weeks ahead of last year's pace. Josh Balling from the Enquirer and Mirror joins us with that story. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, but out here on Nantucket, it's not uncommon. Nantucket real estate sales have topped $1 billion. I'd probably have to say off the top of my head, 8 or 9 times in the last decade, I would say. It's become pretty commonplace, and it's happening earlier and earlier every year, probably on pace for, I don't know, $1.5 billion or more in real estate sales, you know, by the time December 31st rolls around.
Yeah. And 230 million plus sales this month.
There were, and that's the sort of the super high end is really what's driving a good chunk of this market. There's been 4 or 5 of them this year altogether, you know, but it's a complicated picture. You know, prices are softening in the middle and the lower end of the market, even while that overall volume accelerates with these high-end sales. But through September 30th, and October has been just about as much gangbusters, about $1.1 billion in property has changed hands. That's a 22% increase over the same time last year. 268 transactions through September, which is up about 30%, and total dollar volume up about 22%. So prices, at least in the middle and the lower end of the market, and that's a little bit of a misnomer out here on Nantucket. There is sort of no low end of the market.
Right.
There's just the bottom when you've got home prices. The average home price is at $4.23 million, which is actually down a negligible amount from last year. But the median price, the exact middle of the market, has fallen to $2.99 million, which is still a heck of a lot of money.
Only 2.9.
Only 2.9, but that's down about 9% from last year. So it appears that you know, these higher end prices are inflating the average a little bit, but the prices you know, and those lower ends are coming down just a bit, and that's something that hasn't happened in quite some time. There's not, you know, no real fear, no real worry or concern among the island real estate industry out here. But then they are, you know, they believe some of it has to do with, you know, the need of buyers even at that level to secure financing, and the interest rates and mortgage rates are not exactly on the low end. Certainly not as low as they were during and post COVID. So that they believe has a little bit of something to do with it.
And then we heard about the discovery of a piece of a possible shipwreck after last week's storm. Any closer to finding out what it might be?
Well, they're basically certain that it is a shipwreck or the remnants of the debris of a shipwreck of some kind. And now they're working toward narrowing it down to what ship it might actually be. And they have a pretty good idea. Early speculation, informed speculation, is that it could very well be the Evelyn M. Thompson, which was a two-masted fishing schooner built in Gloucester in 1908 that struck a shoal off Nantucket's Low Beach in 1918 and came ashore with about 30,000 pounds of fresh mackerel and 120 barrels of salted mackerel on board. That load was worth about $8,000 at the time, which was quite a bit of money back then. All the crew got off, and then it sort of disappeared over time, and what appears to be a stern post of a vessel from that era was uncovered in the sand by a beachcomber, Karen Russell, who's a metal detector and goes treasure hunting around the island, and she uncovered what certainly appears to be a piece of a vessel from about that time.
Yeah, like I said, never know what you're going to find, right?
You never do.
All right, Josh Bolling from the Inquirer Mirror. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
In Chatham, the Nickerson Homestead, which housed the town's first European settlers, has been declared eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. Ryan Bray from the Cape Cod Chronicle has more. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Mindy.
All right, so what's involved?
Yeah, it's a very detailed process. This all kind of started almost a decade ago. There were two archaeological digs that were done on the 2.5-acre site back in 2016 and 2019 that unearthed literally hundreds of thousands of artifacts that were used to put together a determination study to make the case, for the property's eligibility for inclusion on the register. The town heard back earlier this month in a letter from the Massachusetts Historical Society that it is eligible. So now begins the actual process of applying and being considered. That application process could take a few months by itself. And then after that, you're looking at 18 months to 2 years to go through the listing process. Mm-hmm. So it's very involved, and it's not something that happens overnight by any stretch.
Yeah, it's actually kind of surprising it isn't already on the historic register, right? Considering.
Yeah, you know, you could probably say that about a lot of places on the Cape just because of the history. But yeah, they decided to sort of go down this path of making the case for inclusion, and now they're in it. And now they just got to kind of do the sort of the paperwork and the legwork of getting it into consideration.
Another story you have this week, Orleans special town meeting looking for some land for a new fire station.
Yeah, that's very big news on the town front. Officials have been looking for a site for a new fire station, which they desperately need for many years now. And it's really proven to be a struggle to really find the land that's suitable to make a modern fire facility. But they're in discussions with the owner of a dental office that sort of fronts the existing station on Eldridge Parkway. They're very early in the negotiations. They basically settled on a price, but they still have to work out all the particulars of a purchase and sale. But on the town end, at the November 17th special town meeting, there will be an article requesting $1.3 million to secure the purchase, provided the two sides get to that point where they're ready to make a deal.
Yeah. And is there agreement that this is a good spot then for the fire department?
Yeah. I mean, interestingly, there was always just loose chatter about this office and making some sort of deal going back. And it really is, I think, a game changer as the town sees it, because this is a property that already fronts land that the town already owns where the existing fire station is. So I think the idea is if you put those two parcels together, you've got more than ample room to build a facility. And Also, equally importantly, it would allow the fire department to continue operations out of the existing station when construction is ongoing, if it gets to that point. Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal because that saves tens of millions of dollars in trying to find like a temporary location.
Yeah. All right. Ryan Bray from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks, Mindy.
Coming up, we'll check in on the news from the State House and questions whether a religious group violated child labor laws. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Questions are being raised as to whether a religious group may have violated child labor laws. Jack Styler from the Provincetown Independent has that story. Morning, Jack.
Good morning, Mindy.
So let's remind listeners what the Community of Jesus is and what this lawsuit filed against their leadership alleges.
Yeah, so the Community of Jesus is a religious group based in Orleans, Cape Cod, and for decades, they've been known for these very impressive art programs that they do, but they've also been dogged for decades with accusations of abuse. And in July, a young man named Oliver Ortolani filed a lawsuit alleging that the Community of Jesus' leadership forced him to work at a Brewster construction site when he was just 12 years old and deprived him of schooling.
And how has the Community of Jesus responded to this lawsuit?
Well, the Community of Jesus' lawyer, Jeffrey Robbins, said that this lawsuit brought by Oliver Ortolani was not only frivolous, but borderline fraudulent. And he told us that the boys in question, Oliver and his peers, were volunteered by their parents. And he provided us with basically permission slips or waivers that seem to be signed by Oliver Ortolani's parents.
And so they're alleging that they volunteered the kids, so they weren't working for money. But what were these conditions that Oliver is alleging he had to work under?
Well, Oliver alleges that he was made to work 6 days a week, long hours, sometimes into the night, and that they were grueling, that he was subject to hard work around heavy machinery, and that there were several near misses where children almost got hurt on the construction site, which he says was poorly supervised.
So what does the law say about children that age and what conditions they can work under?
Well, that's the question that we tried to set out in this piece and explore. And I talked to a lawyer who worked for 15 years in the Massachusetts Attorney General's office in the Fair Labor Division, and she told me that this, you know, appears to be a potentially egregious violation of child labor statutes, and that really no kids under the age of 16 can work in construction in Massachusetts. And Oliver's brother, Jake, told me that he was sometimes made to work with power tools and put up on boom lifts 40 feet in the air. And no one under 18, according to Massachusetts law, is allowed to be working over 30 feet in the air, even if they are above the age of 16, which is when you can start working in construction. Mm.
So how does the Community of Jesus respond to allegations that no matter if the children were forced to work there or not, it was still against the law for children to be at the work site?
Well, the Community of Jesus' lawyer, Jeffrey Robbins, said that any idea that there was a child labor violation was ridiculous. But when we asked him to explain why, he said that those questions really should go to Oliver Ortolani's parents.
And were you able to talk to the parents?
No, the parents declined to comment for this story. So there are still some questions that we have about all the circumstances of what exactly happened at that Brewster work site from 2019 and 2020 to 2020.
What kind of oversight is there in cases like this, both at the state and local level?
Well, child labor violations are supposed to be reviewed by the Massachusetts Attorney General's office. And they told me that they can't comment on any specific cases and could not confirm or deny if there was an ongoing investigation into this construction site. At the local level, there are, of course, building departments that do inspections, but building departments usually do scheduled inspections, and the Brewster building commissioner told me that in his time at the building department, he has not done any random inspections of work sites. Oliver Ortolani in his lawsuit says that anytime there was a planned inspection, he and other boys were moved off of the construction site.
And of course, as we mentioned, this is a federal lawsuit, and we'll have more to come as that unfolds, right, Jack?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Jack Seiler from the Provincetown Independent. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The state is cutting back on funding for domestic violence survivors, and some education leaders want to replace the MCAS test with another test. That's according to State House reporter Katie Lannon. CAI's Gilda Geis spoke with Katie to learn more.
The state is cutting funding for domestic violence survivors by about 8%. What would this money typically cover?
This is the most flexible funding source available for programs that work with domestic and sexual violence survivors. So they use it for lots of things, including helping survivors get into a hotel room if they're fleeing an emergency situation and can't find housing, connecting immigrants, survivors with services in their language or that understand their culture, really any number of ways, from assistance with rent and groceries. So there's lots of different types of support that are on the line here.
Why is the state cutting this funding, and how have domestic violence survivor advocates reacted so far?
This is really a tough budget year for Massachusetts when you take the combination of leaner economic times with the shifts in policy and funding coming out of Washington, D.C., is that, you know, budget writers have talked about having to make difficult choices. So for the advocates who work directly with survivors, they say, though, that survivors are worth investing in. They're really calling on lawmakers to put this money back in the budget in whatever vehicle or option is available to them to do that, so that some of them rallied at the State House to really try to highlight the stories of survivors who rely on this funding, like a mother of six who fled an abuser, and one organization helped her keep her kids in a hotel for a month while they look for housing and get food and clothing along the way.
All right. And Massachusetts residents voted to get rid of the MCAS exam as a graduation requirement, many people will remember. So some state education leaders are suggesting a new state-designed exam to take its place. So doesn't that defeat the entire purpose of the ballot question to get rid of MCAS?
That's certainly the argument that some of the supporters of that ballot question are making. That ballot question was interesting for policymakers in that even though it stopped using the MCAS as a graduation requirement, it didn't stop policymakers from putting something new in place to serve that purpose. So it did kind of leave the possibility of a new test open.
So who is proposing a new test, and what do they envision it to look like?
Yeah, there is a 31-member council that Governor Healey created earlier this year to come up with recommendations for a new statewide graduation requirement. So that's lots of folks from across the education and government space. And they have published some draft recommendations. We haven't seen their final plan yet. But that does include the suggestion of an end-of-course assessment that schools would administer, as it sounds, at the end of a class. And that would be designed by the state. So we will stay tuned and see if that end-of-course assessment does materialize or if the pushback from advocates like teachers' unions is enough to push the state to consider something different.
All right. Katie Lannon from the State House, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
CAI's Gilda Geis and State House reporter Katie Lannon. We're going to end the program with John Basile's Sittin' In interviews, which previews a string quartet concert in Falmouth that's all about haunting melodies.
I'm talking with Maura Sean Scanlon, violinist with the Raza String Quartet, which will perform at Highfield Hall in Falmouth Friday, October 24th at 6. First of all, Maura, Raza, where does that name come from?
Yeah, well, Rasa is a Sanskrit word that is somewhat ironically used to describe the indescribable feeling that one can get when experiencing a piece of art, whether that art is music or visual art or anything like that. It's kind of this power to stir something inside of us all. That's what Rasa means.
Now, your instrumentation is typical of a string quartet, but you specialize in music that's a little bit outside the traditional string quartet repertoire. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So all four of us have had extensive classical training. All of us have gone to music school for classical music, but there are various elements in the quartet that kind of have drawn us towards folk music of different types. Mina is from Korea, and Mina is our cellist, and she grew up and is a specialist in Korean traditional folk music. And I grew up playing a bunch of Celtic music, from music from Ireland and Scotland. And so we try to use those influences, those folk music influences, and find ways to kind of weave together programs of music that feature classical music, Western classical music, but also highlight ways in which folk music, such as those types of folk music I just described, have really had a big impact on what's happening in classical music throughout history. And yeah, we try to do this, just it kind of depends on the program, but we love to kind of find any moment to bring, to highlight a folk influence in our programs.
I know you bill yourself as playing the fiddle and the violin, so I guess that's a hint that we might hear some of that Celtic influence?
Maybe so. Yeah, I think this program does feature a little bit of that.
Now, about the Falmouth program you've got coming up, Haunting Melodies by Lantern Light. That's intriguing. Tell us more about that.
Yes. Yeah, so I believe that Highfield Hall and Gardens has an exhibit right now featuring contemporary Japanese prints. So this particular program, I think, is designed to sort of pair with that exhibit that they have going on. So we've adapted this program. We're playing a kind of a tour and going all the way till November 2nd, and where we're playing this kind of Halloween-based tour, spooky tour. So the most of the rest of the concerts are called Soundtrack to a Nightmare. So we've adapted that a little bit to include a few arrangements that Mina has made for our quartet, featuring some East Asian folk melodies. And also, I believe, a movement from a piece called Eight Colors by Tan Dun.
I know a lot of string quartets are associated with maybe a university or a conservatory or something like that, but are you independent or do you have that kind of a connection?
Yeah, we are not in residence currently at any institution or university. We were the ensemble in residence at Exeter Academy a few years ago, but our quartet formed because three out of the four of us went to New England Conservatory all at the same time. And while we weren't necessarily making music in a quartet setting together there, when we all finished school, we had this kind of common bond. And for myself, it's very inspiring to get to play with that group. And yeah, we're delighted to be presenting this program.
The RASA String Quartet performs tonight at 6 p.m. More information and tickets are at highfieldhallandgardens.org. And this is going to wrap up the news roundup for this week. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.